You don't see them on MRI. You don't see them on ultrasound. You don't see them on x-ray. The only way to see them is to actually surgically go into the belly and, oh, look, there's all these scar tissue. I have endometriosis. One of the people we're going to be talking about today is me. I've had five surgeries.
Five.
I don't want to play the cut open Kimberly game anymore. When she starts seeking care, to diagnosis in the United States is 8 to 10 years.
Wow.
That is a lot of damage during that time. So they looked at women with endometriosis who went on a GLP. 68% of women had a significant reduction in at least one of the measures. Over 30% had complete resolution of at least one of the measures.
Wow. Because people are desperate for answers.
Yes. Keep looking, keep asking. It's okay to keep trying and advocating for yourself, and then making sure whoever's driving the bus for you is proficient in GLP-1 medications, is proficient in hormone balancing, and also has no ego.
Yeah. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Kyle Recchia, CEO of FastFit and The Perfect Workout. Last episode, we talked about PCOS, and we're doing some great follow-up episodes with Kimberly Cunningham because we had some videos go viral. So I'm going to kick off talking a little bit about that today. We're going to get into endometriosis. But before we do so, many of you are new and still finding us. And so I want to just give a little bit of Kimberly's background. So I'm going to read through that here. Kimberly is a board-certified nurse practitioner providing healthcare in Colorado for over 25 years. She started Cunningham Clinic with a focus on functional medicine and healthy aging after suffering a life-changing injury that left her immobile for years. Her own recovery was achieved utilizing hormone replacement therapy, and she now teaches other providers how to integrate hormone therapies and functional medicine into their own practices. Kimberly holds multiple degrees and study concentrations from the University of Florida, South Dakota School of Mines and Technology, and the University of Colorado. She is currently on faculty at two universities, an educator for BioT Medical, and is a published author of the number one new release, Great Sex Never Gets Old, Health, Hormones, and Having It All After 40. Her second book, Playing the Long Game, is set to be released later this year. She's in the process of having all her providers functional medicine certified through A4M. So we're just going to dive in, but let me just say that if you missed the last episode on PCOS, I would strongly encourage you to go back and start there, because we're going to just build on that today. All right, Kimberly, question number one I have for you.
Okay, let's go.
It is, like we just said, the endo clip has, as of today, it's at 2.3 million views or so.
Wow.
And I'm shocked. I just feel like it's going to stop. And every day I log in and there's more. This is just on Instagram. The comments are a mix of women finding real hope and specialists asking harder questions. Mm-hmm. Is endometriosis a gynecological disorder, a metabolic one, something else? Let's talk about that first.
So what endometriosis is defined as all of these adhesions that form in the peritoneal cavity.
Okay.
So whether that is after a surgery where there's blood left over in the peritoneal cavity, and each drop of blood can become this, it's like a spider web, these adhesions that form. And you can't, they're not radio opaque, so you can't see them. You don't see them on MRI. You don't see them on ultrasound. You don't see them on x-ray. The only way to see them is to actually surgically go into the belly and, oh, look, there's all these scar tissue. And so is it endometrial lining or menstrual blood that refluxes up through the fallopian tubes, and that's how it gets into the peritoneal cavity? Is it drops of blood left over from a surgery, which could be like an appendix coming out or any other reason to go into the peritoneal cavity? Is it just something that happens by itself? Because what's interesting is men have adhesion formations as well.
And this is rare, right?
It's less common in men, but it is something that happens postoperatively in men. And it's very interesting to me when we look at answering that question, is this a gynecological disorder? Is it a metabolic disorder? There were a lot of comments on that, and I haven't read through all of them because I had patients all week. There were 45,000 comments. But for me, looking at endometriosis, and we talked about the studies in the last episode with the needle aspiration of the peritoneal fluid. Is there enough GLP and GIP in the peritoneal fluid to be effective? And in women with endometriosis, it's looking like there isn't. So is the formation of all this scar tissue and adhesions from the female reproductive system as the starting point? Or is this starting from a metabolic problem, and then this is what comes downstream.
Okay.
I'm in the camp of, I think this is actually metabolic dysfunction first. So it's chicken and egg. They go together. Does one cause the other? Is it just correlation? It's really hard to have causation outside of, I fell out of a tree and broke my arm. I'm pretty sure I know why the arm is broken, mm-hmm. right? We have causation there. But a lot of things go together. And do they go along for the ride together, or does one beget the other? Does one cause the other?
And we don't know. This is why there's sort of this polarizing effect when it comes to social media, because I love that you say we don't know, because a lot of the comments are either we don't know, or we absolutely know, and it's this one, or it's this one, or it's some other crazy one. And so it's great that the truth is, or the evidence points to, we don't know.
We don't know.
And so we can ask those questions.
But we do know that the data is pointing that metabolic dysbiosis and an absence or significantly diminished GLP-GIP production from the small intestine is impacting adhesion formation and impacting adhesion behavior. So when we talk about symptom resolution, or it's gone, the adhesions aren't gone. But the different things we do to ameliorate or lessen the severity of the disease are to prevent more from forming. The only way to get the adhesions out is to surgically excise them. So once the adhesions are there, once the scar is there, we don't have a good way to get rid of it without removing it.
Do you have some experience with this?
Oh, yeah. So I'm going to just finish this and then we're going to talk about it. So what we want to do is lessen the growth from getting worse. And then the growths that are there that we either couldn't get to or grew back right after the surgery, because that happens a significant portion of the time. We want those adhesions because they're attached. They're attached to bowel. They're attached to bladder, ureters, the uterus if you have one, ovaries, your appendix, they're attached. And then in certain conditions, it's looking like estrogen dominance and a lack of GLP-GIP, sugar dysbiosis, they contract. And when they contract and pull, that will put you on the ground. And I can tell you that personally.
That's painful.
I have endometriosis. So one of the people we're going to be talking about today is me.
Okay.
I've had 5 surgeries.
5?
5. Because I'm also one of the ones that grow right back. So when we talk about how to lessen the severity of endometriosis, one of the people I want that to work on is me.
Right.
Because I don't want to play the cut open Kimberly game anymore. It is not my favorite game. Mm-hmm. When adhesions grow around ovaries and then pull, you are on the ground. I'm on the ground, which is one of the reasons why I don't have ovaries anymore. They had to come out. So they tried cleaning up the adhesions around them once, and then that didn't work. And so then we had to take them out.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
So, and I was growing endometriosis tangles, these little scar tissue tangles, these adhesion tangles, after I didn't have a uterus. So the first surgery was the hysterectomy, and then I had to have an appendectomy because one of the adhesions grew around the base of the appendix. So I had mechanical appendicitis, not infectious. And that was about to rupture, so that was an emergency.
So these things are growing, and they're attaching themselves to different areas in the body. And from what you just said, I guess my understanding is this might be an answer to some of the questions I saw, or some of the comments I saw is, no, it's just a hysterectomy, or no, it's just the ovaries. And so for that person, N=1, it was for them. But what you're saying for yourself is, yeah, it might be the case, and then it can be something different, and then it could be another new thing, et cetera.
Well, if it was only menstrual blood refluxing up through the fallopian tubes causing endometriosis, I would have been done after the hysterectomy.
Right.
Not even close.
And men wouldn't be experiencing this.
And men don't have menstrual blood. Mm-hmm. So genetic XY, no uterus equals no menstrual blood. So there's no refluxing of blood. So we know that a drop of blood can seed a whole new array.
Wow.
And so there's all these surgical techniques now that we didn't have years and years ago. There are these barrier sheets they can put down. It's like weed blocker.
What?
But insurance won't approve them the first surgery. Thanks for that.
I'll say it really bad and fine. We'll pay for it.
Until it comes back. And who's got time for that?
Right.
Yeah. So I joke with my surgeon. I'm like, do you want to just install a zipper? Maybe some Velcro? Maybe the next time he's here. But with balancing my hormones with an eye on lower estrogen postmenopausal, because we know that estrogen is implicated in the growth and the behavior of the endometrial adhesions. So do you grow more and do they contract more? So we know that women with endometriosis tend to do better if they don't go through a regular ovulatory cycle. So we either put them on combined birth control pills to stop the ovulatory highs and lows, or we do some other things to manage her cycle so she doesn't have highs and lows. Postmenopausally, we know that women do better with endometriosis disease management on a more conservative dose of estrogen. So I have to be on a lower dose of estrogen than I would like. Because I don't want to go to have surgery.
Right.
And so for me, my estrogen is managed lower, but also I am on tirzepatide. So I'm on a GLP-1 and I microdose that.
With GIP.
We'll get into that. GLP-GIP.
Yep.
So tirzepatide is both. The category is called GLP-1s.
Got it.
Because of the first one was a GLP-1 okay. only. Kind of like cotton swabs are called Q-tips because that was the first one.
Yeah.
So the class is called GLP-1s, even though it's really a class of gastrointestinal peptides. But
right. It's all Kleenex.
And one of them even got a new name. So it was gastric inhibin peptide, and it's got a whole new name, which I wrote down. Glucose-dependent insulinotropic polypeptide.
Yeah.
Rolls right off the tongue.
Yeah.
So that one got a new name. So we're even renaming the peptides we've already started with. So it's a arm of healthcare. So I'm on tirzepatide, which is generic for Mounjaro, and I'm on a tiny dose. I don't have weight to lose. I don't want to lose muscle mass. But without it, the adhesions my surgeon couldn't get to because of where they were located will contract. Mm-hmm. And that hurts. Now, I can't make it gone, but I would like to make it quiet.
Right.
And so I'm on a less than the initial. So the initial dose of tirzepatide is 2.5 milligrams in a subcutaneous injection once a week.
Okay.
For my patients with endometriosis and for myself, I divide that into two shots a week and a lower dose.
What's that lower dose? Is it?
So for me, it's 0.9 milligrams twice weekly.
0.9 milligrams twice weekly.
Is my dose.
Is your dose.
That's the dose where we figured out I get almost complete symptom resolution.
For you, Kimberly.
For me.
Yes.
Nothing's contracting and pulling on me. And I'm not losing weight. So I have to, it's like a razor thin line to try to make sure. Now, here's what's interesting, and there's a study we're going to link to looking at, do you have to take them forever? I will take this forever. If I am late on a shot by more than 12 hours, I can tell you exactly where my adhesions are because they start talking to me.
Does that dosage change per person?
Oh, absolutely.
Because on the comments, people were like, hey, what is microdose and how much and when? And so you have different dosages for different people.
So microdose is also an emerging definition. But in general, microdosing is anything less than, on tirzepatide, 2.5 milligrams weekly.
Got it.
Total dose. So microdosing is less than that. But also, dosing is individual for any condition, any medication. What's the right dose for you is based on a whole host of things. You're lots of things that we're not going to get into. So in my practice for endometriosis amelioration or lessening the severity of the disease. So there's two things. I want to prevent more growth as much as I can through hormone balancing and GLP-GIP balancing.
Okay.
So that's one is let's try to have things not grow anymore.
Is that one thing that's happening when they take this? That was one of my questions, like what's actually happening physiologically?
So unless my surgeon looks back into my belly again and compares the photos, we won't know if I have stopped growing adhesions.
Got it.
Because they're not radio opaque. You can't see them unless you unzip, go in, and look. Let's not do that. So that one is hypothesized, pretty hard to prove.
Got it.
And then the second one, so that's incidence. How often does this occur? How much are these growing? We want to lower the risk of that. And then the second thing is we want to lower the severity of each adhesions behavior. And that one we can look at. And that one actually has been studied. And there's a study that that you're going to link to that is a quality of life study. And it's in a European journal that is not peer reviewed, but it is where studies that are awaiting peer review and are awaiting publication can go ahead and be published.
Cool.
So like, I've submitted this, but you can go ahead and see it. So not yet peer reviewed, but it's a good study. I like it. And so they looked at women with endometriosis who went on a GLP or GLP-GIP. So they semaglutide and tirzepatide. I think it was about mostly semaglutide. I think it was about 70% semaglutide and the rest were tirzepatide. And there were all these different measures of endometriosis, constipation, pain with intercourse, bloating, gas, chronic pain, pain with sitting, lots of measures. 68% of women had a significant reduction in at least one of the measures. Over 30% had complete resolution of at least one of the measures.
Wow.
So that's what I mean is these are tools to reach for to quiet being on the ground when these things can
do. Yes.
So I can't cure lots of things. I can't cure it. But can we reach for a tool to lessen how bad it is when we have exacerbations? And definitely the GLP, GIP medications are looking like they are a very good tool for this. And the data is looking like this was missing in these women anyway.
Well,
from their peritoneal cavity fluid studies. So looking at how to microdose, it is what is the lowest effective dose where we have as much symptom resolution as we can get without too much weight loss.
Okay.
And that razor thin line is what I'm trying to do with each patient. And it's very individual.
You're obviously not trying to lose weight.
No, I'm 117 pounds and about 18% body fat.
Okay.
Insurance is not going to cover this for me.
Right. And this pops up in the comments a lot. I'm not heavy enough for insurance to cover this. So what do I do?
Yeah. And I would like to stay out of the OR.
Right.
For the rest of my life. I don't want another surgery.
And you're focused. This is why you're at FastFit. You're focused on adding muscle to the body.
And on a GLP-1 at my small dose, I have put on 4 pounds of muscle in 6 months.
Wow.
Training with your people.
I love it.
I love it.
Yeah.
I'm trying to not be scrawny. I would like to live in a body that has enough strength to carry me 10 decades if, right, you know, God willing. So that's using medications appropriately in appropriate patients at the minimal dose it takes to elicit a response is where everyone in healthcare should be, whether it's hormone balancing, whether it's using a GLP-1, mm-hmm, like tirzepatide in an appropriate patient. We always want to have the lowest dose. So then we have the lowest side effect. I have no side effects.
Yeah, because we, and this is going to sound biased and like a commercial or a sales pitch, but I don't think it is something that people debate very often, whether or not muscle is a longevity organ. Dr. Gabriel Lyons talks about this all the time. You talk about this all the time. We talk about this all the time. It's one of the reasons we do podcasts, like I said in the last episode, and people might say, Kyle, you're a 39-year-old fitness dude, so to speak. Why are you talking about PCOS and endometriosis, et cetera? And of course, one of my passions is just making health accessible and simple and easy to understand in a complex world. And knowing that most things are chaotic and gray and not black and white. But for me, muscle is not something that we can just say, okay, we'll do these things and sacrifice that.
No.
Which is why you must strength train effectively, efficiently, and with the right stimulus. And so 4 pounds in 6 months, you're driving that metabolic engine, but also that longevity organ in addition to relieving these symptoms, and you're not sacrificing one for the other.
And I also have a genetic connective tissue disorder called Ehlers-Danlos, which makes it very difficult for me to put on muscle already. So I'm on tirzepatide, which, by the way, tirzepatide got a bad rap for semaglutide and tirzepatide. Oh, you're going to lose muscle mass with the weight. If someone has 100 pounds to lose, then probably they will lose some muscle with the fat, mm-hmm, as well. But if they're in the 20 to 50 pound range, if we have hormone balancing and we have good protein intake and we have good weight training, my patients don't lose muscle. They usually put it on. I have an in-body scale so I can actually check your weight in muscle mass, yeah, as well as your body fat percentage every time they come in. And they are gaining muscle, losing fat, and their scores are going in the right direction.
We were, side note, Kimberly and I were, and my wife Tiffany were doing a FastFit session at 6 a.m. or whatever this morning, right out that window, because our FastFit studio is actually in the parking lot of Kimberly's clinic, which is fun.
It's how we met.
That's how we met, because you were training with us.
I walked across the parking lot after a patient came in. I hadn't seen her in 4 months. She chose pellets for her hormone replacement therapy. There's lots of different ways to add hormones and people. She likes pellets. I like pellets. She comes in. I haven't seen her in 4 months. And I said, okay, wait a minute. There's all this muscle mass and you have lost. There's no more belly fat. What are you doing? And she said, I found this great trainer and they're across your parking lot. That afternoon, when I was done with clinic, I walked over there. And I met your regional manager.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Casey.
Yeah.
She's amazing. And so when we were there this morning, there was a member of ours who is now finding you through some of these episodes. And the beauty of that is, and I talk about this in my book, and you talk about this stuff all the time. From my perspective, because people are so busy, it's so confusing where to start. And I always say the first domino from my perspective, or at least one of the first dominoes, is strength training, because it can build your motivation, it can build your belief in yourself, et cetera. But it's that foundation piece. What you said just a minute ago is the ability to come in and then start to balance these things. In addition, these are things that need to stack with each other. And so now we've got people coming and going through strength training, balancing their hormones, using proper medications at the right dosage, not a physician. It's like, I guess I'll just give you more, titrating the stuff properly, et cetera, to get people where they can live a great quality of life while we're still learning about these disease states is a beautiful thing.
So we always want to make sure we start low and go slow.
Nice.
Any of the things we're doing. The first time I went across the parking lot to get on your machines, I'm very competitive.
I've learned this about you.
But I didn't peg it. But by the third time, I was comfortable with Casey. I had a lot of injuries with the Ehlers-Danlos, so that we've talked about this in another episode, but I've had 44 broken bones in my life. And I've had lots of joint dislocations and other issues. And that just, Ehlers-Danlos does that. The hypermobility type, that's the type that I have. And so what I loved when I walked across and I met Casey is, okay, what's your background?
Yeah.
How do you train someone with a litany of injuries? And not everybody comes in with the injury list that I have, but you said most of your clients are over 50. They're going to have, you know, a bad knee, an unstable shoulder, or whatever. And what I loved was instantly the way that the machines are set up. I'm in a very safe anatomical position.
Right.
And then Casey, and then now I have Jesse. The coaching is very clear on form, always making sure. And there's some exercises I can't do just because of my shoulder. And so immediately, oh, let's do this one instead.
Right.
And so I get what I need in 20 minutes or less. And I do it on my way into work because I can control the morning. I can never control the afternoon.
Yeah, you know,
the day starts and it's the day that it's going to be. But I can control 7 in the morning. And so I come here, drop my stuff off, walk across the parking lot, take care of my body, and then come over here and take care of my patients. Yeah. And that has worked beautifully for me.
Just like your area of health, there are a lot of barriers to people getting the help they need. And it's the same thing with fitness. There are a lot of things you can do that can be challenging, that can hurt you, that can be confusing. When I was a trainer with the Purple Workout and FastFit years ago, I mean, I had members who would come, a member specifically I'm remembering, that would come in a wheelchair, on oxygen, going through cancer treatment, 90 years old, and we would do the full exercise and workout.
Good.
And the beauty here is somewhat of a paradox is like, okay, well, do you sacrifice effectiveness with the stimulus because it's for everyone? And the truth is, no, it's more effective than traditional exercise too. So we're not here to talk about that today, but I think that's a beautiful thing. And I wanted to, you have your own experiences here that I think are so important for people to understand, because when they were watching their clips, they're like, who is this woman? And what does she even have to say about this? And like you said at the beginning of this episode, one of the people we're talking to today is yourself. Mm-hmm. And so I appreciate you being vulnerable and sharing that stuff. A question that came up, or the comments were full of something that I have never even heard of, and I'm not going to even know how to pronounce it, but
Adenomyosis. Adenomyosis is a type of growth. It is a tumor, but it's not cancer, and that grows into the uterus. Adenomyosis can happen spontaneously. The Escher coils have been implicated in stimulating that process. So adenomyosis typically is treated with hysterectomy. Now, adhesion formation in the absence of previously diagnosed endometriosis, doesn't mean they didn't have it, but previously undiagnosed endometriosis, 70% of women who make post-surgical adhesions will begin to do so after hysterectomy.
Wow.
So adenomyosis is this growth in the uterus. Typically, the treatment is hysterectomy. Might we consider putting her on a short course of a GLP-1, like tirzepatide, prior to hysterectomy if we have time? Because if GLP-GIP deficiency, either diminished or complete deficiency, either anywhere along the, I don't have enough.
This whole spectrum, yeah.
Might replacing that lower the risk of the upregulation of the pro-inflammatory cytokines that the absence of these peptides creates and make sure her macrophages, which are the white blood cells that clean up the mess, are fully functioning post-op? Might that lessen that risk? I have no idea.
Mm-hmm.
No one's looked. There's no like matched pair study hysterectomy pre-treated with GLP-1, not pre-treated. In my patient population, that's a conversation I have started having recently. Because when you look at endometriosis as, okay, wait a minute, chicken and egg, what's causing it? Going back up the ladder of when this goes wrong, all these things happen. So I'm going to keep going up and until I can't. And this is always evolving.
Mm-hmm.
There's more coming out. There's now glucagon in addition to GLP and GIP and the retatrutide that's coming out later this year. We know about octodecaneuropeptide, which is a glial cell peptide in the brain for sugar metabolism and elimination. So what's that going to become? That's very interesting. There are CTEP medications coming out, and that is to help HDL and LDL share their cholesterol package in a way that is diminished in people with Alzheimer's, especially if they're APOE4 allele positive for that kind of risk for Alzheimer's. So these CTEP medications are looking like they're going to fix that package exchange at the blood-brain barrier. That's very exciting.
Mm.
All of this is still emerging. So, but what's really interesting to me is if we know that after hysterectomy, women have this huge increased risk of making adhesions, and we know that adhesion formation in men and women are looking like they go with this deficiency of GLP and GIP, might we pre-medicate?
Yeah.
It's something that I'm having a conversation with my patients about. If they have a hemoglobin A1C at or above 5.5 and they're going in for hysterectomy, I'm probably going to start offering that as, let's see if we can do this for 4 to 6, 8 weeks before surgery. Mm-hmm. I have no clinical data to support that. These are extrapolations. But if you start looking at, okay, let's look at it functionally. If all of these things are leading to adhesion formation, and once they're formed, the only way we can get rid of them is cutting them out, what might we look at to prevent their formation and lower the risk? Also, if she's postmenopausal going in for hysterectomy and we can time it, if we have time, might we choose to have surgery with a much lower estrogen level? Because we know estrogen has a role in adhesion formation and behavior. So if she can go in as depleted as she can stand it, and then stay there as long as she can stand it, because adhesions usually grow within 3 to 6 weeks post-op, and then you're back to square one. So if we can make it through that window of time, might she have a better outcome this time surgically? And I can tell you, these are all the things I did last time.
Yeah.
And it's been 2 years.
Wow.
So last time I did all this for me, because I just don't want to go and have all these surgeries, and then the surgery begets another surgery, and then, you know.
Yeah.
So this is what I did for me. And I don't have data on a lot of this.
This is just theory
and putting it together, right, and thinking about this.
This is how science works, and N=1 matters. And yes, you're not here to debate whether or not there's a bunch of studies, and we'll see how these things play out. But at the same time, if it's worked for you, it might work for other people. And if they're willing to look at this stuff, then great.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're not, that's great too.
I think you had a question. A lot of people were asking, how long do I have to be on this medication if I have endometriosis?
Yeah, and you kind of answered that by saying for yourself, it was
forever. If it works to either lessen, we suspect, the volume of growth, and there's no way to know without going in and looking. But if a small dose or conservative dose of tirzepatide, that's the one that I like, which is GLP and GIP. If a small conservative dose of that medication given twice weekly, I can't do the once a week because it wears off on days 5, 6, and 7, and all my symptoms come roaring back. So I have to split it. So if a very conservative twice a week dose makes everything quiet, then that's what we do until there's a better option.
Yeah. And what did that cost on average here in the U.S.?
From Eli Lilly or from a compounding pharmacy?
From compounding pharmacy.
Right.
Yeah. So, how cheap can somebody get this in the United States?
So Eli Lilly has a new program called Eli Lilly Direct, and it's about $350 a month at the lowest dose, maybe. It's looking like it might go up on month three. I don't often prescribe tirzepatide from Walgreens or CVS. Most of my patients don't qualify for it. If they did, they would have gotten it from their primary care provider. So there are compounding pharmacies that can make a tirzepatide compound. It is in a ratio that is not commercially available, and it is for patients for whom the commercially available product isn't going to work.
Okay.
So the current tirzepatide that you can get at Walgreens, Walmart, CVS, Target, that is a once a week shot. We've already established that's probably not going to work for endometriosis. It's already a twice a week shot. You only have so many shots per the little clicker guy. So that's going to double her cost.
Yes.
So that's not appropriate. So it's already not commercially available for a patient like that. And so then, yes, we can reach for a compounding pharmacy. That was the big legal answer.
Yeah.
For that. Trying to make it very clear that Eli Lilly does have a patient direct option for medical weight loss.
Yeah.
For those patients alone.
Okay.
Outside of that, we might reach for a compounded version. And that can range from $150 a month on up to some places charge, $800 and more a month. Different practices will have a membership or they will have a per prescription cost. That is also going to depend on the state in which that practice is in, because not only are there prescribing laws, but then there's state laws, and then there's lots of different ways to do compounding medicine.
Sure.
But the lowest dose, the best you're going to find is 150, probably. It's for tirzepatide specifically. You can get semaglutide for less expensive. I don't like semaglutide. It's only one of the peptides. It has the most side effects: constipation, acid reflux, bloating, projectile vomiting. None of this is better.
Yeah,
we don't see that with low dose of tirzepatide. So that's the one I like.
Okay, good. Mm-hmm. Okay, good. Okay, so I think what we're going to do, so this episode's not too long.
I know.
No, it is great. And I could talk to you about this stuff all day. And I'm sure most people are like, please keep going. And so we'll see how this stuff rolls out. And if there's more comments, there's more questions, we'll just keep going.
Yep.
But let's
do meet again.
Let's do two rapid fire questions.
Sure.
And then I'm going to ask you to end it with the same thing from the last episode, which is what do you wish people who are dealing with this knew? Okay. But the first two before that, you've already kind of answered this, but I want to make sure we're super clear for people. So part one, underweight women, thin patients. Patients already struggling with weight. How do you handle that? And you kind of talked about that, but we'll just microdose it. Microdose it, eat the protein, strength train.
Oh, I don't care who you are. Eat the protein, strength train.
Right.
Balance your hormones.
But it's not even an option, so to speak.
None of those are optional.
Yeah.
Balance your hormones. So the strength training, you get a better response out of it. Strength train. The strength train doesn't work without good quality protein. And for women, it's better if you don't go more than 4 hours without protein.
Mm.
So you should protein snack throughout the day.
Okay.
If you want to build muscle. So any human, male, female, with or without endometriosis, hormone balance, strength drain, and protein, and some sleep, because you'll actually grow muscles when you're asleep at night. So you have to have rest scheduled in there as well. So those are non-negotiable.
And then microdoses.
No matter who you are, but yeah.
Forever.
Yeah.
And then part two here. That's great. This came up as a question, and I think maybe people are just curious. When I was going through some of my health stuff years ago with SIBO and some other things, it's kind of like, what am I dealing with, this question, right? So the side effects for GLPs, you said some of them, but GI issues, pancreatitis, gallbladder, muscle loss, bone density, like what's the stuff people should be thinking about? And then kind of what's the screening protocol you look at for people when you're choosing what to give there?
Well, I'm going to start with screening. I do a very extensive set of labs. It's a non-negotiable. If you want any medical care at my practice, you will get these labs. And people come in with their labs all the time, and I say, where's the rest? Yeah. There's no end of information. So I don't take insurance. So there's a set price. It's a significantly discounted bundle. And no, I can't break it apart. If you need any one component of the bundle, you're getting the bundle. LabCorp is happy to charge full price for every single one I break out of that. So we don't do that.
Okay.
I mean, at the third one, you're paying full price anyway.
What's the cost today of that bundle?
$350.
Okay.
That is the entire bundle of labs, as well as a full, it's about 8 or 9 pages of this is what we found and this is what we think. So you get to have that emailed to you, as well as the follow-up visit.
Cool.
So all that's in there. So we start with the labs. Do you even need this medication? Because people come in all the time holding on to extra weight saying, I'm ready. I want a GLP-1. I want to go on tirzepatide. And I pull their labs and their hemoglobin A1C is a 5.0. They don't have, it doesn't look like they have a deficiency of these peptides, but their thyroid might be off or their testosterone is, something else is wrong.
Right.
So first of all, do you even need it? And the labs will really start to tell me that. And then we can have a chat as well about history. So first, do you need it? And then any weight loss journey, any, for any reason, if you've gone carnivore and you're eating a steak and a slab of butter every day and that's it, if you've gone keto, if you've done paleo, if you're doing Weight Watchers, if you joined a gym, if you, any weight loss journey for any reason, including medically assisted, whether that's a GLP-1 agonist like semaglutide or tirzepatide or some of the other medications that help with weight loss that I don't write for because I don't like them, like phenamine, we don't do that. Any of that, fat loss goes through the liver. Without poking a hole in your body, you basically have 3 exits: pee, poop, and vomit. Fat goes out the poop. So it has to get to your GI tract via the liver. That's how you clear it out of the blood and get it out of the body. It doesn't always just evaporate into the ether. You have to actually break it down and get rid of it. So anytime there is more than 20 pounds of weight to lose, the faster the liver has to process that fat, the higher the risk some of that fat sediments down into gallstones or refluxes back up into the pancreas.
Why?
And causing pancreatitis, because you're not supposed to have fat up in your pancreas, in the bile ducts. So we want to make sure that any weight loss journey is slow.
Mm.
Americans are impatient.
Yes.
We want it, and we want it today. We flip the calendar page and go, oh my gosh, that's coming. I have to lose 10 pounds. No.
Mm-hmm.
No, just that's not safe. So 1 to 2 pounds a week maximum is where we don't see that big bump and increase in gallbladder dysfunction and pancreatitis. And with the early use of these medications, they were just ratcheting up the dose every single month, pushing too much fat through the liver too quickly, getting these secondary pancreatitis and gallbladder dysfunction.
That is vital for people to know. I have never heard that. I listen to as much as I can in this space, read as much as I can in this space. And for every one person who's like, you should never take these things because these things can happen, there are 10 more that are like, I took these things and it cured me and has helped me move forward. And so there's always a story to tell and there's context. So thank you for sharing that, because that's a huge deal. And if you, yes, if you want to go lose 20 pounds in 1 week, there are going to be side effects.
That's not good for you.
And if you have somebody that's just throwing these doses at you and ratcheting them up because you want to lose, not to mention the extra, you know, expense of muscle, et cetera.
When you're losing weight that quickly, you were probably losing muscle mass as well, because there's no way you're getting enough protein in your body. And you probably feel so awful you're not going to exercise. And when you lose weight that quickly, your skin cannot rebound as well. And so then you've got sagging skin issues that may or may not recover depending on your age, your collagen and elastin production. So slow and steady wins the race.
It's going to be worth
yes.
it. Okay. Okay, let's wrap it up. Is there anything, anybody watching this who has endo, you know, what's the one thing you wish they knew, or where should they start?
In the United States right now, by the time she's had enough of the symptoms and starts seeking care, which by the way, she's been symptomatic for years. But when she starts seeking care, from initial clinical visit with whatever clinician it is to diagnosis in the United States is 8 to 10 years.
Wow.
That is a lot of adhesion formation during that time. That is a lot of damage during that time. So if you think you have endometriosis and you don't get the answer that you wanted, or the diagnoses that you wanted, or you know, looking at this through a more functional lens, it is okay to get a second opinion, and it's okay to get a third opinion. It's okay. I speak the language. I work in healthcare. I know the surgeons.
Hey.
From my first symptom, which was an adhesion, I had 2 adhesions, one that was around my left ovary and one that grew around my appendix. From that I was hiking and I stood up and I couldn't stand up. I was caught. Something was caught. Because something was caught. It was my left ovary was caught. And I was 2 to 3 miles away from my car and no cell service. So that was interesting.
Yeah. Thanks, Colorado.
I actually just walked through it because I have to get out of the wheel. I live in Colorado and we were on a hike. And so I just had to bent over walk until I eventually it released and I could stand up enough to get out of that. From that point until I had my surgery for the endometriosis was 9 months. Because it didn't look like endometriosis.
Right.
It didn't look like it. I hadn't had it before.
Obviously in the middle of all of this.
Yeah. And I speak the language.
Right. Right.
It took me 9 months before my friend who's a surgeon was like, okay, I'll go in and have a look. And he went, oh my God.
Which is why I think probably when by the time we're done with this episode, it'll be at 2.5 million views because people are desperate for answers.
Yes.
Yeah.
So keep looking, keep asking. It's okay to keep trying and advocating for yourself. And then making sure whoever's driving the bus for you, whoever is leading the endometriosis plan is proficient in GLP-1 medications, is proficient in hormone balancing, is proficient in treating women with endometriosis, and also has no ego.
Yeah.
And is okay with, this is the best I have today.
Right.
I might have something else tomorrow. I might learn more this year.
Right.
If this doesn't work for you, I have a couple of other ideas. If I can't come up with a better idea, I have some other friends in this space that I'm going to call or send you to. So having somebody who is thinking about not just the gynecological part of it, the hormones, but also thinking about the metabolic part of it, and then knowing when to phone a friend.
Yeah.
There's the pelvic surgeon that I send people to here in Colorado. He practices out of Sky Ridge. He's arguably one of the best pelvic cancer surgeons, which actually makes him the best endometriosis surgeon.
Yeah.
Because he goes back into bellies often. And so he's very thoughtful about how to keep that space as healthy as possible, either for the rest of her life, hopefully she never has to have a surgery again, or if we have to go in and do another one.
Wow.
Yeah.
I love it. Okay. So listen, I talk about that in part of my book too. And thank you. I know you went through my book. Is there was this whole section on how to be the CEO of your own health and how to find people. And the two-part story there is exactly what you just said. And then also you yourself staying open-minded, continue to listen to podcasts, continue to learn, listen to opposing arguments, read opposing literature, et cetera, because we're all still learning. And it's these clues and these connections and this team, so to speak, that will really continue to help you to move forward. And I've seen it in my own health, you know, health evolves too, both ways. And even when you fix one thing, we can't just stop. So
I can't find a study before 2022 that is the peritoneal aspirate information. There are a few now, but I can't find one before 2022.
Wow.
So keep hope.
Yes.
Because we didn't even know about this as a tool 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And now we do.
Which is very young in the medical community. Yeah. 15 years ago.
Second to go in medicine.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so how can people work with you?
So we have in-clinic and remote patients. To get started, it's to call the clinic. Right now, we don't have an online registration process. We might have that in a few weeks. We also might not. Just how the online interfaces with my electronic health record. So it's a back of the house logistic thing. So we have people call the clinic,
Okay. Register
as a patient, prepay for those labs, and either come into the clinic to have them drawn, or you can go to LabCorp.
Cool.
There is a caveat: New York and New Jersey, you've got to zip over to Connecticut for your labs because of some state laws. Just full disclosure. But with the $350 panel. And then we'll have you see a prescriber, either myself or one of my nurse practitioners, about 2 weeks later, 2 to 3 weeks later. For me, it's now looking like a lot more than that. But one of my nurse practitioners does have openings in about 3 weeks right now. And they are trained by me. They do it my way. They come and ask me when it's complicated.
The Kimberly Cunningham Clinic. Yes, they need to do this.
Yes. So you're in very good hands with one of my other providers, of course. And then if you're remote, we have a functional wellness program that is a monthly fee, and that comes with a lot of benefits. And then if you're in town, we do have an a la carte menu where you can just pay for what you're using as you go, or the functional wellness program, either one, depending on how you want to utilize this practice. We don't take insurance for anything, not any of it. Some of the diagnostics I order, I can get covered by insurance. And of course, if I send something to Walgreens or CVS, then whatever your copay is.
Yeah. Awesome. All right. Thank you for today.
Yeah.
And thanks for letting us do this in your clinic. I know there's some doors slamming and things like this. This is real life right here.
Yeah.
Yeah. We got producer Ben typing around in the background. We got cars driving by. It's great. So we're going to do one more episode. We're going to go a little bit deeper into this kind of high-level GLPs one more time, how you practice it, where people can get started. We'll keep that one nice and brief, but I want to be able to kind of put a blanket on the rest of this stuff. So we'll see you over there. Thanks for tuning in to the FastFit podcast. We hope you found today's episode inspiring and actionable. If you're ready to take the next step in your fitness journey, visit us at fastfit.com for more resources or follow us on Facebook, Instagram, or YouTube. Don't forget to subscribe, leave a review, and share this episode with someone who could benefit. Together, let's make exercise simple, empowering, and a part of a life well lived. See you next time.